In a dimly lit room at the British Museum, a 46-foot table displays 14,000 pills, the prescription drugs an average Briton consumes in a lifetime. Yet Americans take far more, an estimated 50,000 pills per person. We constitute less than 5% of the world's population, but spend over 50% of global pharmaceutical money. We've become Homo Pharmacum, the people of the pill. These medications have fundamentally reshaped our existence, adding decades to our lifespans, transforming women's social options, and even triggering wars. The book 10 Drugs by Thomas Hager has become a cultural touchstone for understanding this pharmaceutical revolution, praised by medical professionals and history buffs alike for its accessible exploration of how these chemical compounds have altered the course of human history. From Oprah's book club to university curricula, this work illuminates the complex relationship between humanity and the medications we've come to depend on, revealing that no drug is simply good or bad. Each effective medicine brings both miraculous benefits and potentially dangerous side effects. Humans have sought pain relief since ancient times, but the story of modern painkillers begins with opium. This joy plant transformed medicine through the work of pioneers like Paracelsus, the eccentric Swiss physician who challenged ancient authorities and advocated learning directly from nature. His famous laudanum contained primarily opium mixed with exotic ingredients like crushed pearls and unicorn horn. By the 1600s, Thomas Sydenham created a standardized liquid laudanum that made dosing more reliable, while scientific interest grew with researchers like Christopher Wren experimenting on animals. Opium use exploded during the Industrial Revolution, offering cheap relief to factory workers in terrible conditions. It treated epidemic diseases while becoming popular among all social classes, from prostitutes to artists like Byron, Shelley, and Coleridge. By mid-19th century, opium was cheaper than gin and more available than tobacco in Britain. The British East India Company expanded production in India, then targeted China as a market. Despite Chinese imperial edicts banning imports, British traders persisted, increasing sales from 200 chests in 1729 to 4,000 by 1790. When Chinese authorities seized and destroyed British opium stocks in 1839, Britain responded with military force, launching the Opium Wars. By 1888, an estimated 70% of adult Chinese males used opium. Meanwhile, in 1806, Friedrich Sertürner isolated morphine, opium's most powerful component, 10 times stronger than the raw drug. After nearly dying from self-experimentation, Sertürner warned of its terrible effects. The invention of the syringe in 1841 transformed morphine administration, allowing direct injection that turned agony into calm within moments. During the American Civil War, morphine became a battlefield staple, creating thousands of addicted veterans with the army disease. America's first opiate crisis followed, with per capita use tripling in the 1870s-80s. Unlike today's crisis, morphine addicts were mostly middle and upper class professionals, with physicians themselves comprising up to a third of New York City's addicts by 1885. Women were the primary users, treating everything from menstrual cramps to depression. By 1900, mounting deaths drove scientists to search for safer, non-addictive opiates, while governments began regulating these substances, starting a century-long battle against both drugs and their users. In 1978, photographer Janet Parker in Birmingham developed unmistakable smallpox symptoms while working above Henry Bedson's smallpox laboratory. The consequences were catastrophic. Parker died, her mother contracted the disease, her father died of a heart attack, and researcher Bedson committed suicide. This incident prompted worldwide action, with the World Health Organization ordering the destruction of nearly all laboratory smallpox stocks. This crisis marked the final chapter in humanity's longest medical battle. Smallpox had killed more people than any other disease in history, an estimated 300 to 500 million in the 20th century alone. The victory over this scourge began not with modern science, but with the courage of Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, who observed Ottoman women performing crude inoculations in 1717. Despite ridicule from the medical establishment, she had her own children inoculated and championed the practice in England. Later, country doctor Edward Jenner observed that milkmaids who contracted cowpox seemed protected from smallpox. In 1796, he performed his famous experiment on 8-year-old James Phipps, deliberately exposing him to smallpox after inoculating him with cowpox material. When the boy remained healthy, Jenner published his findings, though he faced fierce opposition from the medical establishment and religious leaders who considered his method ungodly. Vaccination gradually gained acceptance, becoming mandatory in many countries despite resistance from anti-vaccination movements. By the mid-20th century, the World Health Organization launched a global eradication campaign, sending vaccinators to the most remote corners of the world. The last naturally occurring case was recorded in Somalia in 1977, marking humanity's first complete victory over a deadly disease. Today's anti-vaccination movement paradoxically thrives because vaccination success has made these diseases seem distant and harmless. Few living people have witnessed smallpox's devastation firsthand. Yet declining vaccination rates threaten herd immunity, potentially allowing these killers to return. The risk-benefit calculation has shifted. Without naturally occurring smallpox, the small risks of vaccination outweigh benefits for routine use, though emergency stockpiles remain ready. By the mid-19th century, medicine stood poised for revolution. While opium, morphine, and nearly all available drugs were natural products derived from plants, modern science was about to transform medicine by creating entirely synthetic drugs, compounds never found in nature. The first widely adopted synthetic drug, chloral hydrate, emerged in 1869 when German chemist Justus von Liebig's former student Oskar Liebreich created it from chlorine and alcohol. Initially hailed as a safe sleep aid, it quickly became popular in mental hospitals and among the general public. Unlike opium or alcohol, it produced dreamless sleep without hangover, though its bitter taste required mixing with alcoholic drinks, creating knockout drops that criminals soon exploited. The Jenny Bosseder case became a notorious example of chloral hydrate's criminal applications. 4 wealthy young men drugged the 17-year-old factory worker before sexually assaulting her. When she died from the drug, they attempted to dispose of her body. This drug cocktail became known as Mickey Finn after a Chicago bartender who systematically drugged, robbed, and dumped customers in back alleys. Despite these dark applications, chlorohydrate's legitimate uses were primarily in mental hospitals, where it proved superior to physical restraints for calming agitated patients. Mental wards of the era were recognizable by the distinctive pear-like smell of chloral on patients' breath. As the first widely adopted synthetic drug, chlorohydrate demonstrated that laboratory-made medicines could match or exceed nature's power. Its success inspired generations of organic chemists to manipulate molecules for specific medical purposes, experimenting with adding and removing atoms to create tailored compounds. This scientific approach, combined with the profit potential of patentable synthetic drugs, helped establish the foundation for the modern pharmaceutical industry. The pattern established with chlorohydrate, initial enthusiasm followed by recognition of dangers and addiction potential, would repeat with countless drugs throughout pharmaceutical history. Each new synthetic compound promised miraculous benefits while concealing unforeseen risks, teaching the enduring lesson that no drug is without both healing potential and harmful side effects. In 1931, in a German laboratory, scientist Gerhard Domach watched with astonishment as mice infected with deadly Streptococcus bacteria, normally a death sentence, survived completely after receiving an experimental red dye compound. After years of methodical testing of thousands of chemicals, Bayer's systematic approach to drug discovery had finally yielded results. Stomach, deeply motivated by his World War I experience treating soldiers who died from wound infections, had persisted despite growing skepticism. His chief chemist, Josef Klarer, had attached a common sulfur-containing side chain called sulfanilamide, sulfa, to an azo dye, creating what would be patented as Prontosil. The breakthrough remained secret for 2 years, until French researchers discovered the active ingredient was actually the simple sulfa component, which couldn't be patented. The drug's American debut came dramatically when FDR Jr., son of President Roosevelt, developed a life-threatening strep infection in 1936. When conventional treatments failed, doctors gambled on the experimental German drug. Within a day of receiving Prontosil injections, his fever began subsiding, becoming America's first demonstration of antibiotic power. His miraculous recovery sparked a national sulfa craze. Drug companies quickly realized that sulfa was unpatented and began mass-producing variations effective against different bacteria. By fall 1937, American firms were producing 10 tons weekly, and doctors prescribed it for virtually everything. But the honeymoon was brief. In 1937, children in Tulsa began dying after taking elixir sulfanilamide, a sweet liquid form containing diethylene glycol, antifreeze. The ensuing scandal, America's largest mass poisoning with 73 confirmed deaths, led to the 1938 Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, creating the modern FDA and requiring safety testing before drugs reached market. During World War II, sulfa powder saved countless soldiers from wound infections, with over 4,500 tons produced in 1943 alone. Meanwhile, Gerhard Domach received the 1939 Nobel Prize, but was jailed by the Gestapo for acknowledging it, as Hitler had forbidden Germans from accepting Nobel honors. Sulfa's success inspired researchers to develop other antibiotics, including penicillin, which Alexander Fleming had first observed in 1928 but abandoned as too difficult to isolate. By war's end, penicillin and subsequent antibiotics like streptomycin and tetracycline revolutionized medicine, triggering the great mortality transition that increased U.S. life expectancy by over 10 years. Sulfa's legacy extends beyond medicine to the modern pharmaceutical industry itself. Bayer pioneered the corporate research model of teams working systematically on targeted problems, transforming drug discovery from an art to an industrial science. But sulfa also revealed a warning. Bacterial resistance appeared as early as 1942, when gonorrhea cure rates dropped from 90% to 75%. This early sign of the antibiotic resistance crisis we face today was largely ignored in the euphoria of the antibiotic age. Henri Laborit's near-death experience in the frigid waters off Dunkirk in 1940 would ultimately lead to a revolutionary approach to medicine. After his destroyer Sirocco was torpedoed, the young medical officer spent hours fighting hypothermia in the English Channel, watching fellow sailors succumb around him. Though rescued, he developed what we'd now call PTSD, describing himself as distraught by the idea of having to continue to live. Reassigned to Senegal, the aristocratic and ambitious Laborit taught himself surgery, but grew frustrated when patients mysteriously died from surgical shock, a condition where blood pressure plummeted during operations. Laborit theorized that shock resulted from both physical trauma and psychological stress, with the body releasing chemicals that triggered catastrophic physiological responses. His revolutionary insight was to target these chemical pathways preemptively rather than reactively. In Paris's prestigious Val de Grasse Hospital, Laborit and colleague Pierre Huguenard developed artificial hibernation, cooling patients and administering drug cocktails to prevent shock. Their breakthrough came when they added antihistamines, which affected the autonomic nervous system. Ron Polanc provided experimental compound RP560, which produced a peculiar effect. Patients remained conscious but detached from pain and anxiety. They recognized their suffering but simply didn't care about it. when a repeatedly hospitalized psychiatric patient failed to respond to conventional treatments, Val de Grasse physicians tried RP-560 at 10 times the surgical dose. Remarkably, the previously uncontrollable patient became calm for extended periods and was eventually released, rational enough to play bridge. This single case publication stirred interest in psychiatric circles. Jean Delay, director of Paris's Santon Psychiatric Hospital, began testing RP-560 on patients like Giovanni A., a delusional 57-year-old brought in by police. After treatment with the drug and ice packs, Giovanni's condition improved dramatically, allowing his discharge after just 3 weeks. The drug's success led to expanded testing. Nurses discovered it worked without ice packs, turning even dangerous patients into meek lambs. Patients became steeped in sweet indifference, conscious but distanced from their madness, often regaining coherence. Some long-institutionalized patients, when asked what year it was, would answer with the date they first entered the asylum, like Rip Van Winkle's awakening. This compound, chlorpromazine, CPZ, became the first effective treatment for schizophrenia and other severe mental illnesses. By 1955, over 2 million patients had received it. The impact was profound. Mental hospital populations began declining for the first time in history. In the U.S., state hospital populations dropped from 559,000 in 1955 to 170,000 in 1980. Straitjackets and padded cells became obsolete as chemical restraint replaced physical constraint. CPZ fundamentally transformed mental health care and our understanding of consciousness itself. If moods and emotions are merely chemical states, they become symptoms to treat rather than essential aspects of identity, a perspective that continues to shape our relationship with both psychiatric medication and our own minds. Unlike most medications, the pill doesn't primarily treat symptoms or save lives. It revolutionized society by severing the ancient connection between sex and procreation. Throughout history, humans attempted contraception through various means, from Chinese women drinking lead and mercury solutions to medieval European women wearing weasel testicles or walking around wolf urine. These methods reflected the desperate desire to control fertility despite religious and social frameworks that viewed conception as divine providence. The scientific pursuit of contraception began in earnest in the 1920s-30s when researchers like Ludwig Haberlant discovered that pregnant females couldn't conceive again until after delivery. Using Rockefeller Foundation funding, Haberlant found that transplanting bits of pregnant animals' ovaries into non-pregnant ones prevented ovulation. He identified progesterone as the key hormone, but faced fierce moral opposition in Austria, eventually committing suicide in 1932. In 1951, women's rights activist Margaret Sanger and her wealthy friend Catherine McCormick, both in their 70s, approached scientist Gregory Pincus with a mission to develop reliable birth control. They faced enormous legal obstacles from the Comstock laws, which banned contraceptives in 22 states and made testing birth control illegal in Massachusetts, where Pincus worked. McCormick funded Pincus's research at the Worcester Foundation, where he partnered with gynecologist John Rock to focus on progesterone as their contraceptive candidate. Two major obstacles remained. Progesterone was prohibitively expensive and didn't survive digestion well enough for oral administration. The first problem was solved when Russell Marker founded Syntex in Mexico after discovering that giant Mexican yams could produce progesterone cheaply. The second challenge was addressed by creating Progestin, a synthetic progesterone that remained active when taken orally. Researchers accidentally discovered that adding small amounts of synthetic estrogen prevented abnormal uterine bleeding, completing the pill's formula. Unable to test in the United States due to Comstock laws, researchers conducted clinical trials in Puerto Rico in 1956, distributing pills to hundreds of women in the Rio Piedras housing project. The trials were ethically problematic. women weren't adequately informed about potential side effects, their complaints of headaches, nausea, and dizziness were often dismissed as hypochondria, and one woman died from heart failure. Despite these issues, the FDA approved Enovid in 1957, initially for regulating menstruation to avoid legal complications. By 1960, when it received approval specifically for birth control, hundreds of thousands of women were already using it. The pill profoundly transformed society by decoupling sex from reproduction. Beyond enabling sexual freedom, it opened new opportunities for women's advancement. After the pill reached widespread use in the 1970s, female participation in graduate education and professional careers surged dramatically. The proportion of women in professions like law jumped from 5% in 1970 to nearly 30% by 2000, with similar patterns in medicine, dentistry, architecture, and other fields. This sexual revolution soon expanded to include men as well. In 1985, scientists at Pfizer's Sandwich Research Center discovered that their experimental angina drug, UK94280, produced erections as a side effect. Recognizing the potential market among aging baby boomers, Pfizer shifted focus to developing what would become sildenafil, Viagra. Through ingenious testing methods, researchers discovered the drug worked by blocking an enzyme that breaks down CGMP, the molecule that relaxes arterial smooth muscle to enable engorgement. Viagra teaches two critical lessons about the pharmaceutical industry. First, drug companies desperately need blockbuster drugs to survive, as development costs have skyrocketed to over $500 million per drug. Second, the most profitable drugs don't cure anything. They treat ongoing symptoms. Quality of life drugs that address symptoms rather than underlying conditions can be prescribed indefinitely, creating endless revenue streams. Big Pharma's quest for non-addictive painkillers as powerful as opiates has ironically led to America's worst addiction and overdose epidemic. The chapter explores how synthetic opioids, more potent than natural poppy derivatives, were designed partly to cure addiction, but ultimately worsen the problem. At Germany's host labs in the late 1930s, researchers accidentally discovered pethidine, meperidine, Demerol, while searching for a muscle relaxant. This represented something revolutionary, a powerful painkiller with a molecular structure completely unlike morphine or other alkaloids. Initially marketed as non-addictive with fewer side effects, pethidine proved to have numerous side effects and significant addiction potential. Host continued developing synthetic painkillers, eventually creating Amidon, later renamed methadone, 5 times more potent but causing significant nausea. Though initially believed non-addictive, methadone proved dependency-forming. Its unique properties, oral administration, slow onset, reduced euphoria, and unpleasant side effects, made it unsuccessful as a painkiller, but promising for addiction treatment. In 1963, New York physician Vincent Dole obtained a controversial grant to study drug treatments for heroin addiction, despite threats from the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. Working with psychiatrist Marie Nyswander and physician Mary Jean Creek, Dole discovered that while morphine was ineffective as a heroin substitute, methadone showed remarkable promise. Patients maintained on methadone stopped craving heroin and remained functional rather than sedated. Dole's team found that maintaining patients on methadone indefinitely was the only viable solution, a trade-off of one drug for another, but a better choice. Methadone patients weren't breaking laws for money, using dirty needles, or overdosing. When Dole and Creek presented their results in 1965, methadone maintenance treatment, MMT, entered a honeymoon period of wild enthusiasm. Belgian physician Paul Janssen abandoned teaching to start his own drug company, becoming one of history's greatest drug discoverers. With an alchemist's heart and businessman's mind, Janssen identified the 6-sided piperidine ring, common to both natural opiates and synthetics like pethidine. By 1957, his company developed phenoperidine, 25 times stronger than morphine. In 1960, they synthesized fentanyl, over 100 times more potent than morphine, at the time the world's most powerful opioid. By the early 1970s, scientists were discovering how cells communicate through molecular receptors. Researchers found that opioid receptors could be turned on by agonists like morphine and fentanyl, but also turned off by antagonists like naloxone, Narcan. Throughout the 1970s-80s, researchers developed numerous molecules to modulate receptors in different ways, hoping to solve the addiction problem. Despite this growing science and a century of research and social programs and government initiatives, America's opioid problem has only worsened, with the U.S. now consuming 80% of the world's opioids, despite having less than 5% of its population. The opioid crisis has escalated despite scientific advances. Prescriptions more than doubled between 1992 to 2015, with overdose deaths increasing fivefold. Today, opioid overdoses kill more Americans than car accidents and gun homicides combined. Multiple factors drive this epidemic: the pharmaceutical industry's endless pursuit of new formulations, the $10 billion prescription opioid market, doctors' time constraints leading to quick-fix prescriptions, and the ease with which patients develop tolerance and addiction. When prescription access tightens, many addicts switch to cheaper, more available heroin, often dangerously laced with fentanyl. If statins exemplify pharmaceutical marketing power, monoclonal antibodies represent medicine's nobler side, born from scientific dedication and altruism. These precisely targeted, guided missiles are revolutionizing treatment approaches. Produced by clones of identical white blood cells, monoclonal antibodies, recognizable by names ending in MAB, include blockbuster drugs like Humira, Remicade, Avastin, Herceptin, and Rituxan. The breakthrough came in 1974 when Cesar Milstein, an Argentine scientist at Cambridge, and his German colleague George Kohler conceived a revolutionary idea: fuse immortal cancerous myeloma cells with normal antibody-producing white blood cells. Despite the improbability of success, they created viable hybrid cells, hybridomas, that could both live indefinitely and produce specific targeted antibodies. In what the author calls one of the most selfless and admirable moments in the history of drug discovery, Milstein and Kohler published their findings without patenting them, openly sharing their techniques and materials with other researchers. The patent disaster eventually caught Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher's attention. A chemist herself, she was outraged that Americans were profiting from British discoveries. The mistake triggered policy revisions and warnings to scientists about sharing ideas without securing patent rights. The old ways of open sharing were replaced by commercialization and profit-seeking. Labs and companies raced to develop monoclonal antibodies for various targets, representing a watershed in drug development. Unlike traditional methods of screening countless chemicals hoping something might work, researchers could now create hybridomas producing antibodies precisely matched to specific targets. Despite limitations, they're expensive to produce, can't penetrate cell interiors, and can't cross the blood-brain barrier, monoclonals have become medicine's biggest thing, with the market expected to reach $140 billion by 2024. Looking toward the future, drug discovery is moving from the traditional test-many-chemicals approach toward manipulating genes, cells, and microorganisms. Modern biotechnology companies design medicines based on deep understanding of disease mechanisms, creating highly targeted treatments. Beyond human DNA, researchers are beginning to manipulate the microbiome, the billions of bacteria and viruses inhabiting our bodies that contribute to health in ways we're just starting to understand. The integration of computing with pharmaceuticals takes multiple forms. The simplest places, tiny sensors in pills that signal when medication is taken, like Abilify MyCite, the first FDA-approved digital drug. Drug discovery itself has gone digital, with supercomputers visualizing complex proteins before laboratory synthesis begins. These in silico approaches allow scientists to design targeted drugs on screens, potentially lowering costs and accelerating discovery. With affordable genome sequencing now available, we can identify individual genetic variations that affect health outcomes and drug responses. Personalized medicine promises treatments tailored to individual genetic profiles. However, most concerning conditions like Alzheimer's, cancer, and heart disease involve complex interactions between multiple genes and environmental factors over time, not simple single-gene defects. The pharmaceutical industry faces mounting challenges, skyrocketing R&D costs, flattening sales growth, and diminishing innovation. Some insiders worry they've harvested the low-hanging fruit of drug development. Yet, these companies remain profitable, regulatory savvy, and politically connected. Their greatest vulnerability may be reputational, as the medical profession increasingly finds itself bought by the pharmaceutical industry. We need new models based on public funding for public good. Regardless, science will continue advancing, and great medical breakthroughs against heart disease, dementia, diabetes, and cancer are coming. Though, whether they'll be accessible to all remains an open question in our profit-driven healthcare system.